all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach it at 800-693-4800. We have a fascinating interview to bring to you today on Veterans Radio. We're going to talk about the aircraft carriers of the world. We have the pleasure of talking to Barrett Tillman, who recently wrote On Wave and Wing, The 100-Year Quest to Perfect the Aircraft Carrier. Barrett, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thank you, Jim. I'm proud to be aboard.
Well, we're glad to have you. You have quite a history of writing in this space as a military expert. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to take on the project about writing on the aircraft carrier.
Well, a couple of years ago, it just occurred to me, it flashed on my middle screen that this year, 2017, would be the 100th anniversary of the world's first true aircraft carrier, which was HMS Sirius, used by the British Royal Navy in World War I. And there had been a considerable amount of publicity in this country for the official centennial of U.S. naval aviation dating from 1911, which was the date of the first trial and error experiment of landing an airplane aboard a moored cruiser. But that was a lot different from conducting actual flight operations at sea, which is what the British did with Furious in 1917 and 18. So the fact that I was not aware of anyone else who was taking notice of this historic centennial is what prompted me to write On Wave and Wing.
Well, I've got to tell you that this is one of those books where you wonder, okay, is it going to capture me in the beginning? And the beginning captures you. I have to tell our Veterans Radio listeners that you've done a great job from the first chapter on, bringing us into the early years of really what was a bit of a crazy experiment to first fly off of a ship, and then the next step was, geez, I wonder if we can land on the ship. Tell us a little bit about those early years and the first pilot who flew off the USS Birmingham.
The first carrier aviator was an interesting character who I take some pride in describing because I was born a fourth generation Oregonian. Eugene Ely was a Portland, Oregon automobile salesman who was bitten by the flying bug, tried teaching himself to fly, and that did not work too well. So he linked up with Glenn Curtis in New York, who was one of the most significant early aircraft designers and pilots. And in fact, Curtis was a bitter, bitter rival of the Wright brothers. They were in and out of court for, I guess, about 6 or 8 years over patent disputes having to do with aircraft design. And finally, the U.S. government intervened during World War I and said, both of you knock it off and go back to work. But in the meantime, Eugene Ely and his then new boss, Glenn Curtis, had managed to approach an influential naval officer, a forward-looking Navy captain, and convinced him that there was potential in the concept of a platform that we now would call a flight deck on a warship that would allow airplanes with wheels, that is, land planes, to take off and land aboard, whereas previously Curtis and other designers had only experimented with waterborne aircraft, which today we would recognize as flying boats and float planes. But Eugene Ely plunked his pusher aboard the cruiser Birmingham off Norfolk in November of 1910, got off safely, flew ashore, and 2 months later, taking advantage of better weather in the West Coast, he successfully landed aboard another cruiser with an improvised flight deck. That was the USS Pennsylvania. And oddly enough, that's where things stood for many years, because having demonstrated the concept, the U.S. Navy sort of shrugged and said, well, that's interesting. So that's why I date the centennial of the aircraft carrier for publication of On Raven Wing to 1917, when the British converted a battlecruiser HMS Spurious into a genuine aircraft carrier.
Well, and listeners, we're talking to Barrett Tillman, who wrote On Wave and Wing. And one of the things that I think captivates the readers here, Barrett, is you've gone through the archives and found some great photographs of those early planes and early ships that were part of this grand experiment. Tell us a little bit about how you found some of these photos.
Many of them were already in my files, because depending upon how you count it, On Wave and Wing is approximately my 53rd book. That includes anthologies and introductions and whatnot. But I had written approximately 30 previous books about various aspects of world naval aviation. So I had a good start, and actually it was somewhat frustrating, because by the time I settled with Red Marine History's editors, I probably could have provided between 200 and 300 photos. But to its lasting credit, Red Marine suggested a color section, and consequently that's why in the middle of the book there's that 16-page portion with over 30 color photos from before World War II up to the present.
Well, I've got to say, these photos, particularly the early ones, really help tell the story. Walk us through the progression a little bit about the aircraft that flew on and off in the early years of carriers. I think many folks probably haven't thought about those early aircraft.
As you'll see in the book, Eugene Ely flew a really primitive flying machine, although in 1910 and 1911, it was pretty much state-of-the-art. It looks more like a box kite with an engine on it. Excuse me. But subsequently, the British began operating soft-lift aircraft off HMS Furious, both the Pup and its successor, the comic strip-themed Camel. And then after the United States started experimenting in 1922 with our first carrier, USS Langley, we saw a progression from simply modified land planes to designed for the purpose and manufactured specifically types aircraft aboard our subsequent carriers, such as the sisters, USS Lexington and Saratoga, leading up to the World War II Essex class. And that was a fairly quick evolutionary process from biplanes in the 1920s well into the 30s, and then all-metal monoplanes, such as the World War II generation of Grumman aircraft, such as the Wildcat and the Hellcat fighters, the Avenger torpedo plane, the Douglas Nautilus dive bomber. And then we saw the post-war explosion in the late 40s and early 50s with jets that, of course, take us right to today.
Well, and I think really that's part of the story that's told here, is the significant role that aircraft carriers played for the United States and for Japan in World War II. Give us a high-level view of that.
Well, unknown to the rest of the world, in 1941, the Imperial Japanese Navy was the global leader in aircraft carriers. not just because they had a strong fleet of carriers with fairly advanced ships and world-class airplanes, but the Japanese, far more than anyone else, were visionary in imagining how you could most effectively operate carriers together. And since neither the U.S. nor the British Navy had given serious thought to operating more than two or perhaps three carriers together, and only then on rare occasions, the Japanese initiated what I call a 20th century shock and awe by grouping six fast aircraft carriers embarking about 400 airplanes and sending them clear across the North Pacific, undetected, to launch the Sunday surprise at Pearl Harbor. And one of my valued colleagues, another noted naval historian, John Lundstrom, has aptly described the Japanese carrier striking force as a sort of 1941 atom bomb because nobody else came close.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that the book on Wave and Wing also gets across is the important strategic value in the naval maneuvers that the aircraft carriers played for both nations in the Pacific. Walk us through a little bit about how that played itself out through World War II.
The United States Navy in 1941 had eight aircraft carriers in commission, and that included our first escort carrier, a small ship called the Long Island. Well, fast forward 2.5 years to the Mariana Islands in mid-Pacific, June of 1944, with the invasion of the strategic Japanese islands of Saipan and Guam, which were seized in order to put B-29 bombers within range of Japan. Well, the U.S. carrier force supporting that operation was Task Force 58, with 101 ships of all types. And for one of my previous books called Clash of the Carriers, examining what's popularly known as the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, of those 101 ships, over 80 have been commissioned since Pearl Harbor. So that's just a stunning achievement. But when you look at the total American war production throughout the Second World War, even that accomplishment pales to what things look like at the end when we had 99 carriers in commission of all types. So we can argue about the Tom Brokaw's hype about the greatest generation, but what we cannot argue about is that the World War II generation were by far the greatest producers of stuff in recorded history.
Yeah, and that was advanced technology at the time. Let's talk about the progression of, if you will, of how you land these things onto the carriers and the progression of the technology, both on deck, but also in the men that evolved over time to make the carriers what they became by at the end of World War II.
Well, up until the early to mid-1950s, all aircraft carriers had straight decks, what we call axial decks. And I wrote a book with my long-departed friend, Wally Schirra, one of the original seven astronauts, who, like many of the early astronauts, was a naval aviator. And he said in those days, either you had an arrested landing or you had a major accident, because the only way to protect aircraft and people farther forward on a straight deck was a series of woven wire barriers that would fit flush with the deck when they're not in use, and then hydraulically they could be raised to snag a carrier aircraft that had overshot the arresting wires. And consequently, when jets came to be, their higher landing speed posed a serious problem with safe carrier landings, and the accident rate just soared. So our friends, the British, again, had come up with the ideal solution, which is the angled deck. And if you look at any carrier today, you'll see that there's what appears to be a runway addition on the left side, on the port side, usually angled about 10 degrees so that landing aircraft can snag their arresting wires or not, and they can go around for another try safely rather than risk hitting aircraft that are parked on the center line of the deck. So that was just a huge change. And in my opinion, as I mentioned in On Wave and Wing, it probably saved carrier aviation in the jet age.
Well, and it really demonstrates just one of the ways in which sort of trial and error had to occur so that the aircraft carrier could evolve as technology wants to do over time. The same happened with how you gave guidance to the pilot on how he was doing on his approach. Walk us through that a little bit.
You bet. Dating from the early 1920s, the landing signal officer, better known as just the LSO, was usually a qualified aviator who stood on a small platform on the port side aft of the flight deck, and he held brightly colored paddles in his hands, giving standardized signals to the carrier pilots who were approaching, as they say, the back of the boat for an attempted landing. Well, that system worked pretty well, although, again, the Japanese were ahead of us because they had not a human but a mechanical reference that was two lights, one red, one blue, that were seen from the cockpit of the approaching aircraft. And when those were in proper relation to each other, it gave the pilot automatic feedback on line up for his center line and his glide slope. And that concept was expanded in the 1950s, again, by our British cousins, who invented the mirror landing system with a gyro-stabilized lens projecting a what they call a meatball. It's a red dot above a or below, depending on the case, a horizontal row of green datum lights. So we still have LSOs, and they still control the landing operations, but they do it with a microphone and reference to the mirror landing system. And that's another factor that saved carrier aviation in the jet age, because it, with the angled deck, was highly responsible for reducing a terrible accident rate.
And we're speaking, listeners, to Barrett Tillman, author of many military books and on topics related to aviation and naval history. This one in particular is on Wave and Wing. For those who are listening, Barrett, who maybe don't understand how long a aircraft carrier might be and how many people it takes to man it, give us some sense of that size and scope.
Well, today we have 10 carriers in commission. They're all of the CVN 68 Nimitz class, dating from the mid to late 70s up through 2009, I believe, when the last one was commissioned. And those ships are fairly uniform in size and capacity. They're about 1,100 feet long, and fully loaded, they can displace upwards of 100,000 tons. And that includes the approximately 70 aircraft that are aboard. And in order to make those ships work and understand that they're powered by nuclear reactors, you need a little over 5,000 sailors and pilots, staff officers, air crew to get the job done. So it's a huge enterprise, but we've been doing it so well for so long that to the uninitiated, it just appears routine.
Well, and we don't give enough credit to our Navy men and women who deploy and do this so well for us. But let's move a little bit to what the current world's, taking a world view, who's got aircraft carriers in the world today?
Well, oddly enough, of the other nations that currently have carriers in commission. Three of them were originally built in Russia. The Russian Navy does have a fully capable, deployable aircraft carrier, but two others of similar design were incomplete when the Soviet Union fell apart around 1990, and subsequently China and India purchased those incomplete ships, had them towed to their respective nations, and completed them in the past several years. And those are conventionally powered ships. That is, they have fuel oil propulsion, whereas France has a smaller nuclear-powered carrier, the Charles de Gaulle, which has been working with elements of our Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean off and on for the past few years, helping contribute to the fight against ISIS and other enemy elements in the Middle East. And then Britain, which got out of the carrier business in the late 70s, now is returning with two ships of the Queen Elizabeth class, and they, like our new Gerald Ford class, are over budget and late, but I believe that both of them are expected to go operational in the next 2 or 3 years. So we're looking at a renaissance of sorts with world navies realizing that carrier brings tremendous advantage to those nations that possess them. And, of course, if we remember our grade school geography, 70% of the planet is water, which means that aircraft carriers can appear almost anywhere on the periphery of the world's land masses and launch attack aircraft from hundreds of miles offshore.
And some might think that aircraft carriers are dinosaurs, but based on what you've just reminded us of our world geography, and also the fact that China is flexing its muscles in the South China Sea and has just commissioned its first operational aircraft carrier, do you see a future for the next 50 or 100 years for aircraft carriers, or are they dinosaurs?
We keep hearing that aircraft carriers are dinosaurs, but we keep building them. And to me, that's separate from the political, financial aspects of the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about. The Chinese are all in for carriers. As I say, their modified Russian ship has been experimenting at sea, I think, since 2012. And they're nearing completion of their first homegrown carrier, which might be the first of as many as a six-ship class of carriers. So we're certainly going to see more in that regard. Whether the Russians continue building more carriers, I haven't heard lately. I would be surprised if they did not. But in the meantime, as far as drones and remotely controlled carrier aircraft, you'll see a couple of pictures in the book on Wave and Wing of remotely operated, that is, pilotless drones taking off and landing from aircraft carriers. And those drones can serve multiple purposes. The original concept was reconnaissance and surveillance, especially where you're reluctant to send humans in manned aircraft. But more recently, the option seems to be aerial refueling, in-flight tankers. So the future is definitely wide open for a variety of options with aircraft carriers around the world.
Well, we're just about out of time. Barrett Tillman, author of On Wave and Wing, where can folks find this excellent book detailing the 100-year quest to perfect the aircraft carrier?
It's available online at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, and then I've had live sightings this week at Barnes & Noble retail outlets, so On Wave and Wing is on the shelf there as well.
Well, I want to thank you for taking a little time today speaking to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.